Hello, everyone. My name is Matt Hollingsworth, and welcome to another episode of The Remote Show, where we discuss everything to do with remote work with the people who know it best. Thanks so much for listening. The Remote Show is brought to you by WeWork Motley, the largest community of remote workers in the world. With over 220,000 unique users per month, WeWork Remotely is the most effective way to hire. My guest on today's show is Patrick McKenzie, or Patio 11 on the internet. Patrick is a software engineer by trade, has founded four different small software companies, and now works for Stripe. You all know about Stripe already, but the small version of it is that Stripe's mission is to increase the GDP of the internet. Patrick's role in Stripe is to increase the number of successful software companies on it. On a day-to-day basis, Patrick writes code, requirements documents, strategy memos, the Stripe Atlas guides, which if you haven't checked that out, is absolutely awesome. He also advises Stripe employees, partners, and users. If you're not already following him, you should do so. He's Patio11 on Twitter and all other internet platforms. And if you're not already using Stripe, I don't know what you're doing, but you should be using Stripe to process payments and build your business online. Patrick, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, super excited to talk to you. Stripe has been one of those companies we've had our eye on you and what you've been up to, and it's been lovely to watch your progress. But yeah, I'm super excited about this, and I hope you are too.
Yeah, always love talking to smart folks about interesting subjects.
For sure. So where I like to start these conversations now, and I found it to be pretty interesting as a jumping off point, is what is it that you've been most proud of that you've done over the past 12 months?
Interesting. I've got a two-part answer here. So I'm a husband and father. I have a four-year-old daughter and a two-year-old son. And so I think the strictly speaking accurate answer is attempting to work the father thing for what it is worth, and knock on wood, hopefully that is going reasonably decently in the last 12 months. The more professionally relevant answer is stretching my wings a little bit at Stripe between projects that are more similar to the kinds that I've been doing over the last several years and projects which are different in character. One of the things that we've been moving into quite actively is hiring remote engineers. Stripe had not historically been a company that had done that in a considered and scaled fashion. And then we looked at the data early this year and came to the conclusion that, the sort of small but mighty team of remote engineers that we had opportunistically hired over the years was extremely outperforming relative to our various benchmarks for engineer performance. We said, wow, if that is working so well, let's have more of that. And so we came to a kind of ambitious plan to hire over 100 remote engineers this year. And that's been an all hands on deck effort from a number of people in the company, myself included. And one of the things that I have been doing the last couple of months is setting up a program to do what we call remote coffees to basically give people the opportunity to hop on a Zoom call with some Stripe engineers and engineering managers, hear a little bit about our engineering culture, our practices, what some of our projects that we're working on right now are, and sort of have the opportunity to meet their colleagues before they get into a more formal, send us a resume, we will schedule a time for an interview sort of hiring process. And that's been very successful, both from the perspective of meeting a lot of interesting people, being able to give the pitch to a lot of folks, and from the, you know, sort of business results thing of what does it do for our hiring funnel.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot to unpack there, and I'd love to get into that a little bit more, but I think it would be valuable for our listeners just to take a step back and to talk about your role at Stripe. Actually, I don't know how long specifically you've been working with Stripe. Sounds like you have a pretty unique role. And then I'd love to get into what that role specifically is, and if there is any specifics that you sort of spend your time on most, and, you know, why Stripe chose to bring you on, if you can. Probably a difficult question to answer, but if you can answer that, I'd love to get into that as well. So what is it that you're doing at Stripe right now?
Sure. So I've been at Stripe about 3 years next week. Prior to that, I ran small software businesses from here in Japan for the last 10 or so years prior to that. So what is my role at Stripe? It's a little bit squishy. There's pluses and minuses to it being a little bit squishy. The easiest thing that doesn't lose too much fidelity to the truth is that I'm a senior individual contributor on the marketing team. But even there, things get kind of fuzzy. So the first 2 years that I worked at Stripe, I was working on the Stripe Atlas, which is one of our products, which helps entrepreneurs worldwide get set up on legal and financial rails to start their company off on the right footing. And even when I was working primarily on Atlas, I was doing a little bit of everything, as one does when one is working on a project that's in the earliest stages. As one of the relatively few people on the team that had an entrepreneurial background, worked a little bit on the product side of things, if you're an early stage entrepreneur, what do you need and what can we actually provide you? Worked quite a bit on writing the Stripe Atlas guides, or later causing to have written the Stripe Atlas guides, which are ways to teach people the art and science of running early stage tech companies. I worked as sort of tier three customer service for a lot of Atlas users. We tried to establish the expectation that Stripe Atlas users could write atlas@stripe.com with basically any question about their business. And as long as we were legally able to answer it, we would try to answer it. And so we would get things from, how do I raise investment, to, my co-founder and I are going through a breakup, I need a shoulder to lean on. And so that is not the typical sort of question that comes into a customer support channel for a company. And answering that was sometimes a bit challenging for us. And so tried to, A, pitch in on answering those sort of things, and B, kind of build up a process that would allow us to have a good user experience for that unbounded kind of question. Kickstarted the Stripe Atlas community, which is now run by my colleague, Matt Richman, and then just tried to pitch in on a lot of projects across Stripe. The current rescoped marketing role, I continue to pitch in on a lot of projects, including, as we talked about, the recruiting thing with remote engineering.
It sounds like the role that you're in would be only doable by somebody like yourself. So I guess, was it a role that they were specifically looking for, or did the executive team at Stripe know you and know what your experience was, and then sort of created something around your skill set, assuming that you could, of course, contribute in a positive way to Stripe? Was there one process that they had for that, or was that just a job that was posted, I guess?
I think there's a little column A, a little column B. So Stripe knew at the point when Atlas was off the ground that they wanted someone to do a lot of writing for the project that eventually became the Stripe Atlas Guides. And they, you know, had the rough outline of, okay, well, there are subjects that entrepreneurs don't really understand that well when they start their entrepreneurial journey. Everything from marketing to sales to bookkeeping to how does one de-risk a product that you're building. And they wanted to be able to teach that at scale. And so, you know, find someone that can teach that at scale was, as far as I'm aware, a open job rec with a nicely designed page and everything prior to me being involved. And I was sort of a known quantity among a number of people on the internet, inclusive of folks that worked at Stripe at the time in, say, early to mid 2016, where that conversation was rolling around internally. And so they reached out to me and asked me if I was interested. At the time, I was still the CEO of my last startup. So I said, well, flattered to be offered. If there was any place I would take a job, it would be Stripe, but doing the CEO of a startup thing right now. And unfortunately, the startup didn't end up working out. So I said, well, if you're willing to revisit that conversation, I'd be willing to have exactly one conversation with the company prior to trying to jump in both feet on what would have been my fifth or sixth software company at that point. And so we went through a interview process, and they liked what they heard, I liked what I heard. And so I've been here mostly happily for the last 3 years.
Yeah. So with that, I would be curious to hear, because I have been following Stripe, as many people have, and it's been amazing to see sort of how the business has evolved based on the core product of course, payment processing and making that as easy as possible. And it seems like it's going more now into how can you add more value into building startups generally and building online businesses as a whole. So I would love to talk about sort of your interest in the Stripe platform, and prior to coming on, what really drew you in and what got you excited about Stripe?
Well, the line that I use is sort of an applause line. By the way, I suggest people, when you're interviewing for a position, have a few applause lines ready, because why not? A lot of companies will attempt to qualify as to whether you are enthusiastic about the product and the mission, et cetera, et cetera. And my applause line, which isn't a thoroughly literal statement, is that I've fed my family out of a Stripe account for the last 6 years. Want to continue feeding my family? That would be great. But I've been the customer. I've run a business online, and I had been using the payments product since approximately... let's see, Stripe came out in late 2010. I think I signed up for my Stripe account in early 2011 and had used that to run two of my businesses to decent, at least by my expectations, levels of success. And the capabilities that it gave me as someone who was a first-time entrepreneur for the first business and not really connected to high-quality entrepreneurial ecosystems were pretty amazing. I remember when I started my first software company way back in the day, back in 2006, actually blew 15-25% of my budget on faxing a paper contract internationally to one of the legacy payment providers so that I could get set up to take credit card payments. And then after going through, I want to say about 2 months of underwriting rigmarole with PayPal, got approved to take payments through PayPal. obviously, while I work for a direct competitor these days, I will still say shout out to PayPal. They've empowered a lot of entrepreneurs worldwide, and I'm extremely happy for their success and the fact that they do have a pretty quality product in a lot of ways. Anyhow, I started using Stripe. Stripe was amazing in a lot of ways back in 2011. Very, very clean APIs to integrate against. There was an easy integration story into people's own websites, which was a relatively difficult integration story with most of the other providers until quite recently. And the quality of the dashboard experience was, I had the impression from the first day that someone must be like actually running a business on top of it, because it does some things that are really not obvious requirements, but make life much easier for me. One from back in the day, and I'm still impressed by this, is that if you go to the dashboard and you go to the search box and type in the last four digits of somebody's credit card, which you'll often do in the course of supporting a customer who says, hey, I paid for it with a card with the last four of blah, 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 and I didn't get my product. What happened? If you type in the last four, it will immediately pull up the associated transaction. That was not a thing a PM would like obviously come to the conclusion of, this is something that my search bar needs to do without any further clarification. But that sort of like sparkly attention to detail on the product was a thing that majorly drew me to Stripe, both as a customer and then later as a prospect and or employee. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's and being a Stripe user ourselves, that attention to detail is certainly one of the things that I think keeps us happy. I know keeps us happy and many others happy as well. And so it's very clear that there's a lot of thought that goes into all that kind of stuff, and it's, the product is as good as it can be. So super interesting piece there. Now, when you started at Stripe, was the concept of remote work, it sounded like there may have been some engineers that were working remotely at the time. It sounded like you have some experience as well working remotely, but that wasn't widely adopted. Was that correct?
I believe that Ron's correct. We've had engineers working remotely since almost the earliest days at Stripe, I want to say. 10 employees or so in, and there was no formal program, and it hadn't really been scaled to materiality. So I was working remotely for the Stripe Atlas team, which was based out of San Francisco, while I was working here in sunny Tokyo, and that was a not terribly common state of affairs back then. It is much more common these days, and we intend for it to become even more common in the future.
So there was recently an article, I think, written, or an announcement that you were doing a widespread sort of hiring spree specifically for remote work. And I guess in our mind, not having known that there was remote workers within Stripe already, it seemed like that was sort of the decision that was made at that point. But it doesn't sound like it was a one decision kind of, this is what we're doing now. It sounded like it was more of a gradual process of coming to that conclusion. Does that sound about accurate?
Yep. I think that a lot of major strategic initiatives are something which you sort of find yourself, I don't know, the frog boiling metaphor is not exactly the correct metaphor to use in this circumstance. You do something once by accident or happenstance, or because you're trying a portfolio strategy of new experiments that works out, you put more resources into the experiment, it continues working out. And at some point, the organization needs to make a decision of, from the large portfolio of experiments that someone in the organization is running at any given time, which are the ones that the organization as an organism unto itself wants to very seriously dedicate some firepower behind. And by the early 2019, we had overwhelming conviction that remote work was the future of going to play a material part of the future of engineering work, both at Stripe and the industry broadly. And we were like, well, if we think all the savvy companies are going to be here in 5 years, our customers are going to be here within 5 years for the ones that aren't here already, we should certainly steal a march here and build up our remote team and understand this new and emerging organizational technology that the industry will be building on in the next couple of years.
Yeah, and obviously we are a huge proponent of that, sort of the phenomenon that we've seen over the past, especially 2 years, where this has become more and more popular. But it's quite rare for, well, I shouldn't say it's rare, but it's more common for companies to start out as remote teams, obviously, and it's just logistically easier. It's broader talent pool to pull from, all that kind of good stuff. Less rent expense, obviously, when it comes to having a physical geographic HQ. But rarely do you see sort of a larger established company deciding that at one point that this is something that they wanted to take on and moving towards a fully or more distributed workforce in general. What was that decision like internally? And in terms of when you did make that decision, what was the next step for you? Was it a matter of coming up with processes, procedures, things like that? Or was it kind of building off of what you had already done? Or what was that decision like? And then what was the aftermath of that decision for you internally?
So I think there were a number of things that happened. One was we'd had a number of engineers working on Stripe who had successfully worked as remote for a while. We put a person that was basically in charge of the remote initiative at Stripe. His name is Aditya, and he is our remote DRI, directly responsible individual. And I believe my understanding is that he spent quite a bit of time interviewing the existing remotes, asking them what about their experience had been very positive, what mechanisms with respect to big picture things like management and little picture things like literally what is the kind of microphone that you use and are you happy with it? Tell me about the space that you do remote work from. Are you happy with it? I believe he spent some time himself experimenting with lighting setups to feel like he could participate fully in remote calls over Zoom, et cetera, et cetera. And so there was a bit of a research process internally. At the same time as the research process was running, there was also a sort of internal socialization slash getting everyone on the same page around that, you know, we are still a small company in the scheme of things, but we're not the smallest small companies anymore. So there is a bit of the riding a ship that has momentum behind it element going on, where for a number of years we had been sort of lukewarm with respect to remotes organizationally. And we're saying, okay, we are going to make not exactly a 180 degree change with respect to that policy, but we are going to make a material change with respect to policies. So communicate the desirability of that internally, make sure that, for example, you know, it would be a bad thing if like our recruiting department learned the fact that we were enthusiastically recruiting remote engineers when they woke up and read Hacker News that morning. And so talking to teams internally, talking to teams that had remotes, asking what they had done to successfully integrate those remotes into the culture of those teams, reviewing results from our company-wide survey with respect to, we do a company-wide survey twice a year to all employees and are sort of classifying results by remote versus non-remote and seeing where the underlying issues still were, seeing what we should prioritize for the things to fix in the scope of the next 6 months or so. And then preparing for, you know, one does not simply wave a magic wand and hire 100 people. Among other things, you have to interview many, many more than 100 people. And you also have to have more than 100 open slots in your organization and people who are definitely willing to have a remote colleague working in one of those open slots. And so there was a bit of a finding the right teams that were hiring folks and that had the internal communication norms that we thought that their first or second remote employee would have a very successful experience from the jump.
Yeah. So it sounds like the more deliberate approach to remote work and has been, it's pretty early days for Stripe, it sounds like. That being said, it sounds like there's also enough time that has gone past in terms of the remote teams that you can pull some data out and you can make some conclusions as to what's working and what's not working. Is there one thing that you can point to, and again, this is a difficult question, but is there one thing that you can point to that has been a major pain point that you maybe didn't expect after the deliberate change to be a more remote team?
I don't know if I would say this is something that I didn't expect, but one of the major challenges has just been the challenge of hiring at scale. Finding, if you work back from the way that funnel math works to hiring 100 people, you want to interview some number of hundreds of people, which probably means having initial team screens with low thousands of people, which requires engaging at some level, some higher thousands to low tens of thousands of people. And so just, identify 10,000 people in the world who would possibly be interested in working at Stripe is a non-trivial problem. And then making sure that both our existing hiring technologies port over to people that are the remote candidate pool, which is a different candidate pool than the ones rather that we hire for our on-site positions, both in engineering and outside of engineering. And we are both attempting to grow rapidly on this while also attempting to integrate the people that we are hiring, while also attempting to keep the wheels on the Stripe bus. Those sort of things are obvious challenges, but they don't stop being challenges for being obvious challenges.
Right. That makes sense. And I think you're in a unique position to be able to answer this question because you've had some remote experience in the past, and it sounds like you've been remote for most of your time at Stripe. Have you noticed a deliberate, maybe not a policy change, but a way of approaching the culture aspect of Stripe when it comes to remote teams? And it sounds like it's a semi-distributed. So you do have an HQ and there's also engineering teams outside of that that are fully remote. Is there something within that sort of policy that you have that is getting out in front of the potential downsides of having a semi-distributed workforce, like having people that are in an office and some people that aren't? Or is that not something that you've considered as an issue? Or how do you approach that?
I think that the situation has been getting quite a bit better over the last couple of years. One of the nice things about this being a formal initiative at Stripe to hire many more remotes is that there is both a level of understanding that this is a thing that we're committing to at the same time as the relative proportion of remotes, both organization-wide and on particular sub-organizations, like, say, the engineering organization or any given team that has remotes on it, the proportion is going up and quite steeply. And so there's no longer either the feeling or reality of being like the only remote on a team or having like a unique position where you kind of have to like advocate for the unique challenges of your position. The organization is getting better at anticipating your needs. Shout out to one person who shipped a particular thing at Stripe. I believe this engineer is a remote herself. She said that it was socially awkward when a meeting would be called and people use the internal system to calendar up the meeting and book a room for the meeting and then not add a Zoom link to the meeting. And so as the remote, you would have to ping people on Slack saying, hey, I would like to attend this meeting as well because I'm on the invitation, but I can't attend the meeting unless we make a Zoom room and dial the room into that Zoom link. And so we made a not too complicated bit of software to say, okay, if there are 2+ people meeting at Stripe in a room, just assume that there needs to be a Zoom link open for a remote joining that meeting. And so now the onus isn't ever on remotes to say, hey guys, would really love to be here. Please include me. Considered in isolation, that's a little thing. Like it's a tiny stitch in the craw of person that has to make that ask perhaps a couple of times a day, but like a tiny stitch in the craw of somebody a couple of times a day with respect to their core relationship with their coworkers is like not a tiny thing, particularly when you aggregate it over hundreds of days times hundreds of engineers. And so removing that like point of friction forever is a absurdly good use of our internal systems engineering time, right? And that's one of the things I love about working here is that literally every engineer at the company can contribute to internal systems. My one patch that I can remember is making it possible to use digits in someone's internal username because I really, really wanted Patio11, which is my username that I've used for forever. And at one point that wasn't possible for technical reasons, so possible now. But the amortizing the cost of like an internal system thing over many hundreds of engineers in a similar situation gives you quite a bit of business impetus to do whatever it is that is necessary to maximize the productivity of those people.
Yeah, you mentioned something there as well that I think is important to touch on. And again, you would have a unique insight here. So one of the big things, obviously, with remote work and one of the downsides is that there is that level of isolation that I think is just a structural component of working remotely, obviously. And, you know, you don't have that ability to tap on people's shoulders if you want to chat about something outside of work or even within work. So is there something that you do individually that helps with that isolation piece? Is there something that you do to make sure that you aren't feeling that level of isolation within your workplace?
If you don't mind, I'll answer it on the team level prior to the individual level. One thing that I really appreciated that the Stripe Atlas team did when I was on it, and I believe this was spearheaded by our engineering manager, Alex. We'd had one or two people on the team that were remote for the majority of the team's existence. There was a circumstance which caused us to hire several more remote employees in a moment. And Alex said, it would be great if all of us achieved a sort of like emotional understanding of what it is to be remote. So why don't we all as team do an experiment where we just work remotely for a week and then we can understand what about our team communication norms or about our standing meeting schedule makes life difficult for our remote colleagues and fix those things. And also like just have an emotional understanding of like, you know, how does the water cooler relationship with coworkers work when you will only be around the same water cooler for perhaps 5 or 10 days a year? So we ran that experiment, found out some things. There was a great deal of empathizing across the team about that and then made some changes as a result of it. What do I do in my personal life? I make a special effort to invite people to come out to Tokyo. I just hosted a coworker of mine here last week. And while he was in town, did a bit of both actual hands-on work, actual purpose to come out to Tokyo, and a bit of taking him around for things like karaoke, which is both a standard Tokyo socializing activity, also a bit of a hobby of mine, out to some of the restaurants in my neighborhood, et cetera, to give them a slice of life of what I experience every day. Similarly, I try to get out to San Francisco, where the majority of my colleagues are, as often as possible to both experience a slice of life and also do the sort of hacking your monkey brain thing with regards to your tribe is whoever you break bread with, right? So even as a remote employee, it is extremely useful to be able to break bread with your team as often a year as you can manage it. There's some very micro tactical things that I've gotten outsized results on. Sometimes like teams just, you know, do something to have a team outing together, like in San Francisco, there's a bunch of people on the Stripe Atlas team who really like tapioca milk tea. I think it's usually called boba tea in the United States. So it's like, I'll get boba. And when the Atlas team gets boba, I get boba, despite the fact that I can't like physically consume with them. So I go out to the neighborhood boba shop here in Tokyo and get a boba. And then I take a picture of the boba and send it into our Slack channel, just so everyone can like feel that I'm virtually participating in that team bonding activity.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the sort of the organizational piece of it, and you mentioned that there was an initiative that you'd done to make sure that everybody was aware of what it is like to work remotely. But is there anything that's encouraged in terms of daily activity that you have to sort of fight against that level of isolation that people feel on a daily basis?
I think that we have a lot of autonomy with regards to how we interact with our coworkers and what team communication norms are. So there's many teams that have different practices there. Some have a standard calendared sort of like a meeting with no agenda, where it's just 30 people in a room, don't talk about work at all, just have the substitute water cooler conversation. I haven't participated in that myself, but I think that plausibly it works for people if it works for people. Some have they make a special effort on the team to encourage appropriate level of one-on-one meetings just to maintain team bonds. Some try to, in addition to our cross-company meeting that we do once a year where we fly substantially everyone out to HQ, they try to do like a meeting once a year where everyone goes to a third location, quote unquote, to have an offsite and have the opportunity to both do some focused work together and renew acquaintances. So various kinds of experiments with respect to that. I think establishing good inclusive norms of communication with respect to remote employees is probably the most important thing for a company that is transitioning from a past where they didn't have that many remote employees to a future where they will have lots. And that means, for example, making sure that important decisions are made in a way that people can participate in, made over Slack or a Zoom call versus two people talking in the hallway, that important decisions are communicated in a way that people can see the decisions that are impacting their work actually have been made. Stripe had a sort of like baked in advantage in that we had communication norms in the company to send lots and lots and lots and lots of email. Now, we've written about this online, but A, Stripe sends a lot of email internally. B, the super majority of that email is widely visible within the company. And so the fact that many of our big debates as a company were happening over email threads or in a shared Google document helped to have our early remote employees and the ones that we're employing as a result of this initiative be more included than in the like counterfactual world in which if most of our decisions were made in meetings and you can't actually be in the meeting, then that does not optimize for your ability to participate in that decision. I also think one of the challenges of remote work is that the social nature of when you are the only person calling into a room of like 13 people who are all physically present in the room, you're in the meeting, but not really in the meeting. So there is like a critical mass factor that helps with regards to that sort of thing. Also, it helps to acknowledge that there's a differential there that doesn't go away even when it's 10 people in a room, 3 people outside the room sort of factor. And it's one of the things where if that is the distribution of your workforce, then you just have to acknowledge that as a factor and either like push the important decisions into places other than meetings or establish like communication norms such that people understand that, oh, if there's a speed of light delay between myself and someone whose opinion I value on this call, then put natural pauses in where we're speaking such that they can jump in with what they want to say. Or people have other solutions like holding the talking stick, et cetera, et cetera. Haven't seen that work super well in any particular instantiation, but as the entire industry jumps on the remote train, I think that there will be many thousands of experiments run and some of them will bear fruit.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that one of the interesting things about watching this phenomenon play out is the technology that has popped up around some of the pain points that come up with remote work. And it's going to be an interesting thing to watch, but it is also interesting to think about the fact that there are some things that are encroaching on the benefits of remote work too, which is the nature of being able to put your head down and work hard on a problem and without being distracted. So I'm hoping that there's this sort of a happy medium that gets matched here with technology that improves and the efficiency of remote work and yet doesn't encroach on some of the benefits of remote work, because it's a fine balance, I think.
I think to the extent that inviting any group of people into your organization helps to bring the figurative DNA, the practices, the culture, et cetera, into the organization. To the extent that we think that remote work is delivering on the promise of giving knowledge workers a way to deep focused work, like demonstrating to organizations that deep focused work is so valuable that you should carve out space to protect it. It's a thing that is difficult to transition from without a major catalyzing event behind it. But if the inclusion of remote workers is that major catalyzing event, possibly that there will be organizations that manage to like leverage that across the entirety of their employee base.
Interesting thing that you mentioned a while back was, well, sort of indirectly, I suppose, when we first started the conversation, was just the idea that it might be difficult to separate, I suppose, work from time outside of work. So I guess my question is, within Stripe, and I know that Stripe has a values output and excellence is a really big part of your culture, how do you manage to make sure that people aren't overworking themselves and aren't pushing themselves into a place where they're going to be burnt out and unproductive and still maintain that level of excellence that you expect?
Mm-hmm. So starting from first principles, I don't think that the level of excellence requires overwork. In most cases, I think that overwork tends to cause people to perceive that their output is going up, but generally decreases the absolute amount of output and generally causes hits against the quality. And in most cases, when we're making the trade-off, we prefer less work done at a higher quality than more work done at substandard quality. We attempt to keep the quality bar really high. There's talk about some of the cultures and practices that sustains that later if you're interested in it. Towards the general question of how do we encourage people to draw the balance between work and other responsibilities in such fashion that they can do their best possible work while not dropping their other balls, super candidly, I wish I personally was better on this topic. We attempt to preserve a lot of autonomy for people such that they're able to make whatever are the sensible trade-offs given their particular stage in life, their particular values, what they're optimizing for right now, et cetera, et cetera. There are some trade-offs you can make in remote, like with respect to scheduling flexibility, which are, for a variety of reasons, just more difficult if you work in an office every day. It is relatively easy for me as someone who works remotely to take off an hour or two in the day and just shift my schedule a little bit to do something like cover childcare for my wife or run an errand or two. And that is more difficult if I were commuting to an office just by the logistics of like have to commute in, have to commute out, have to commute in, have to commute out again. So that sort of thing can, without doing a big change on the raw number of hours worked or the amount of output created, create a, I don't know, a flexibility dividend with respect to your ability to meet your other commitments during that day. Part of it is sustainability has to start from a culture. It has to start from people up and down the organization modeling it as something that they truly value. And I think we have mixed results with respect to that. We're a high-flying Silicon Valley company, have many hard-charging individuals at it, and good for them. Making sure that we can support different work styles as well is an important thing. Making sure that people feel recognized for the work that they get accomplished rather than judged on the basis of whether their work style conforms with the company normative work style, if that were a thing that existed, is important. I think also there's probably transition points in the life of a company where when it is six people or 12 people together, there might very well be a company normative work style where the right work style is the one that all of your coworkers would adopt without consciously deciding to adopt it. But when you get to 600 people as the day I joined or 2,000 people as of these days, the company will sort of by necessity have to adjust to the reality of that. It has employees that have many different work styles. You know, we have offices in many different corners of the globe that have sort of very different professional cultures or cultures with respect to work styles prevailing and the sorts of folks who usually staff professional positions. And so some amount of adapting to that reality has to happen.
Yeah, no, that's interesting that you mentioned the piece of the reality of having different offices, maybe in different geographic locations. I hadn't really considered that because I suppose I haven't really talked to very many other companies that are at your scale in terms of the number of people that are working for you. It sounds like as well, it's really up to the individual to come up with whatever system works best for them. And with the understanding that as long as the product or the output is up to the standard of Stripe, then that's sort of the way that is best suited for them. And that's fine. Is that sort of accurate or do I have that wrong?
So I would hope there would be more support from their manager in the organization than just saying it's up to the individual to figure things out. Ideally, we have some organizational understanding of what success looks like, and we can model success and have people choose from a variety of options available to them. This is different for different people in different parts of the organization and different for different jobs. But in some jobs, there's sort of a constant cadence of in sort of a user operations role. There might be a relatively constant number of tickets that come in every day, and you do a relatively constant number of tickets every day, and that is what good execution looks like. In a job like engineering or design or writing, you might be doing creative work. Creative work doesn't necessarily schedule in X unit of outputs on Monday and then X units of output on Tuesday, both because the business needs of the business don't schedule in that fashion. And also because the spirit is willing, but the muse does not decide to come in for work that day. And so you kind of have to like adjust to that reality of the work. But hopefully you will be doing it in the context of an organization that, this is not the first time we have hired an engineer. We understand that productivity is not a constant measured over every day. And we've adapted to that reality and adjusted in the context of a helpful, empowering culture, both among your colleagues and in your management chain.
Mm-hmm. I'd be curious to know if there's something, because I was asked this question actually recently and I didn't have a very good answer. So I'm hoping that maybe you can help me out with it. If there's anything specific in the hiring process of, let's say in your case, in the engineering side of things, if there's anything specific in terms of personal characteristics that you look for when you are hiring a remote engineer versus hiring an in-house engineer, is there anything that jumps out at you in terms of differences that you would look for or qualities that would make somebody a successful remote worker versus someone that wouldn't be as much? Or is that not something that really comes up as much?
I think that comes up sometimes with regards to early career professionals is that there is sort of a skill curve on learning how to work. An organizational technology that we as a society have developed for papering over early career professionals' lack of that skill specifically is the office environment. The office environment kind of provides the sense of having someone looking over your shoulder and sort of enforce discipline with regards to starting and stopping and maintaining a pace and talking to colleagues on a particular cadence, et cetera, et cetera. That sort of enforced discipline does not happen so much with respect to remote workers. And so you generally have to be at a higher point along the skill curve of core life skills for working at a professional company. And you have to be a little bit better with respect to self-discipline and self-motivation. And also belief those are true and will likely to remain true over the next couple of years in the transitionary state we find ourselves in. I think you also have a little bit more of than an office-based employee with respect to bearing the organizational burden of like making sure conversations between you and people at, say, headquarters or whatever office that you're communicating with most frequently happen. You have to proactively cause those conversations to happen, both for like core execution on projects and for career growth. Hopefully that will change over time as we get better at integrating remote folks into the organization. But that's a true statement of reality. In September of 2019, you kind of have to be proactive with regards to managing it yourself. And so combination of those things is both an important thing to assess for, also an important thing to level set with regards to candidates. There are people who really, really enjoy having someone who will check in with them regularly and make sure that they're on task and provide that structure. And we should be upfront with remote candidates that, if you're expecting someone to like spoon feed structure for you, this role at this time in this company might not be a great fit for your interests. Conversely, if you are someone who has like run a business before or is just super motivated and is capable of like providing that organizational structure for yourself, then that is great because you very heavily tick one of the boxes of what we think will likely be a requirement for being successful in doing this.
Yeah, it's always an interesting one. Like I said, I didn't have a very good answer for it, but it seems like it's just one of those things where you just have to be better in a lot of different areas and not specifically one characteristic or one personality trait that allows for quality remote workers. You just kind of have to be better in a lot of different ways. And maybe that's the answer.
I think that there's also a component with respect to the dominant word in remote work is work. It isn't remote. There's no one characteristic or one skill or one personality trait that makes a good engineer. People will spike differently in different places of that. And even with an extreme level of, for example, core technical acumen with regards to, Kubernetes or whatever your tech stack of choice is, you would probably not be all that successful in many jobs and certainly wouldn't be successful at Stripe without quite a bit of communication ability. At Stripe in particular, there is a heavy emphasis on written communication. And so people who do well in writing documents, whether it's design documents or arguments for where the business should go or updates to the company after shipping something, people who do well at that do well, and people who have difficulty expressing themselves in writing, Stripe would be a really difficult company to work for. And in a similar fashion, like if you're working remote at Stripe or another company, there's some blended collection of skills that are sort of specific to the remote nature of it. There's a larger blended collection of skills that somehow combines into your effectiveness within the team that you're working on, the role that you're working on, the organization that you're working within. you kind of have to bring a portfolio with enough depth in the right places and enough breadth overall to be successful.
Yeah, no, it's quite an interesting subject, and I hope that it becomes clear for a lot of different people because I think it's an important one. What I wanted to ask you too is, and this might be a difficult question to answer because, you know, projections in general are difficult, but how do you see remote work going within Stripe? Is this something that you're looking to test for and then maybe expand to other portions of the company? Or how do you see the future of remote work within Stripe?
I think we don't have any major announcements to make with respect to this other than the one that we made earlier this year. From my limited point of view with respect to the outcomes of this experiment / initiative, all speed ahead with regards to remote work. We truly believe deeply as an organization at many different levels in the organization that remote has not been a standard part of all software companies or all savvy employers of engineering talent in the software, tech, and related industries over the course of the last 10 years. And we believe strongly that that will change. My internal timeframe for it is probably 5 years from now. It will be about as common as Git is, and Git is pretty darn common at this point. Git wasn't everywhere as of day one either. But I think that all of the savvy teams and savvy organizations are going to have tens of percent of their engineering pool, or engineering teams rather, work remotely. And I say engineering just because I am engineering by trade and by sort of self-identification, even if I work on the marketing team, I don't ship code that much anymore. But I think this is broadly true of many other types of work as well. And so with increasing adoption of this by both our industry and a variety of other industries, with the technology for it getting better, and with sort of like organizational comfort levels at this getting higher as more and more companies experiment with it and see success and develop the systems and processes and technology that will allow them to achieve higher levels of success in the future, I think the adoption curve is going to start going upwards in a material fashion. And we are trying to race to be there before everybody else is.
Yeah, no, it's great to see Stripe on the wagon for sure. We're excited about it, and we're excited to see where you go with it. So I wanted to take another sort of step back here, and I want to talk a little bit about your writing. I'm glad that you mentioned that is one of the core parts of the Stripe culture, and what's important to Stripe is writing, and it seems very clear that that's the case for you. And being a Twitter follower of yours, it's I'm always fascinated by the scope of your interest, I suppose, and just what the different avenues you go down and how deep you can go, and it's really just quite something to witness and to be to see. It's really quite something. So anybody out there who isn't following Patrick yet, we'll link to his Twitter feed, and you should start doing so immediately because it's really amazing. But I was curious to know if there's something that you if there's like a scope of what you find interesting or what you set out to explore and then you go explore that thing, or how is it that you go about just what you find interesting, what you do deep dives on, I guess is my question. Like, what do you decide to do to dive deep on in terms of your research?
Sure. So that's an interesting question. I have very broad intellectual interests, and one of my hobbies is picking up more obscure ones. So generally attempt to go very broad on things and then occasionally go very deep when the spirit moves me. Sometimes it's because I've been capable of like diving deep on a subject because there's some like actual legitimate business need to understand that subject very well. Candidly, what happens more frequently with me is that I am exposed to something by business or life. You know, the original reason I got into engineering was that, the original reason was that I wanted to play more video games, and writing them would be a great way to have them. But the thing that kept me in the field was that I love tearing apart complex systems and seeing how they tick. And so when I'm exposed in a material fashion to, you know, one of those systems that just like floats around our ambient environment, but that we never like think of in a very detailed fashion, insurance, or how do stock exchanges work, or how does money like move around the global economy? I have a tendency to sink my teeth into something and just not let it go for a while. There are generally being two ways to get information out of the world other than discovering it oneself. One is reading what other people have written. The other is talking to other people. I'm a little bit shy, so I often end up reading in preference to talking to people. But there is a surprising amount of information on Google these days about basically any subject that you could possibly want to read about. So if you want to dive down a rabbit hole of what the consumer credit reporting regulation looks like in the United States and read the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and the Fair Credit Reporting Act and the various regulatory state machines around those two pieces of legislation and how they interact with the credit reporting agencies. And I feel like I'm getting a little bit off the beaten path, but this is sort of the way my brain works, and that subject like seized my interest in 2004 and wouldn't let me go for a few years. And go figure, it turns out that if you end up working at a company that processes credit cards for a living, understanding the credit card ecosystem is kind of useful. But yeah, sometimes the idea grips me and just won't let me go for a while.
Yeah, and I've learned so much from you just from following you on Twitter. So thank you for being so public about that. I appreciate that. And I know many others do as well.
Thanks very much. I'm Patty11 on Twitter if anyone wants to follow me. And also patty11@stripe.com if you ever want to send me an email.
Yeah, no, we will definitely link to those things. I'm curious if writing publicly about the things that you're interested in, what is that outside of just your own distilling your thought down into whatever Twitter is limiting you to at the time. Is there any other sort of major benefit that you find in being so vocal and public with the way that you write and what you write and how you write, I guess?
Oh, goodness. You could do an entire podcast entirely on that and the various benefits of having a body of work that are publicly available. I almost certainly would not have my job at Stripe, but for the fact that I wrote several million words on the internet. That's the situated from someone who was in a small town in central Japan at the time. Life would not naturally have exposed me to people at high-flying startups in San Francisco or the Silicon Valley Bay Area, but the internet is a leveling force. And if you write interesting things on interesting topics, you can eventually come to the attention of people who might be, you know, looking for someone to write or do engineering or design, et cetera, in places that you wouldn't naturally be. Your name will get brought up in rooms that you wouldn't be in, et cetera. So it is a huge friend catcher. Anyone doesn't follow texting podcast recommendation for them. But one of the most useful things that I learned from them was this concept of a luck surface area, where the amount of quote-unquote luck that you have in your career is proportionate to the product of the depth of how much you help people and the breadth of how much you tell about it. And the writing publicly is one of the highest leverage things that you can do with regards to increasing that breadth factor without having to do quote-unquote more work. I say that in scare quotes because 5 million words or whatever my odometer is up to, they didn't write themselves for free. But much of both the actual impact that I've had in my career and the benefits that have accrued to my family and myself as a result of my career are directly downstream of having written a lot.
Hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. And I haven't heard it framed in those terms, but I think one of the pieces there you mentioned is being helpful. And I've mentioned it in a few other podcasts, but I think being helpful is one of the most underrated skills that someone can have, especially when they're starting out their careers. How do I find somebody that I admire, that I want to work for, and how do I help them is, I think, a really easy in the first principles starting point to go.
Mind if I give one more gloss on the writing topic that is less relevant to personal career interests and more relevant to the organizational case for this?
Please do. Yeah, please.
Sure. So even at Stripe, a company that has a very strong writing culture, I think we internally and externally have not nearly hit the point of diminishing returns with regards to how much we write. Stripe is growing at a stupendous rate every year. And for the sake of argument, I'll assert that there exist some companies in the world that are growing at 2x per year in terms of most relevantly to the succession employee count. And a intimidating and unescapable fact of the math is that if a company sustains 2x growth in employee count per year, that the first year you work at that company, half of your colleagues will have less than 1 year of tenure. And the second year you work at that company, half of your colleagues will have less than 1 year of tenure. And the third year you work at that company, half of your colleagues will have less than 1 year of tenure. And this is really, really not the way that organizations are quote unquote designed to work. You have to pour a incredible amount of effort into educating people about both what you do, how you get it done in your particular organization, and the why. Like, why was this decision made? Because there will be people like enacting a company, a ritual or a policy or something 3 years from now who were very much not in the room. And you need to kind of have the institutional memory of why you do the thing that way, both so that those folks can make a determination of, you know, have circumstances changed. Should we change this? Or rather than just keeping it a stuffy policy or ritual in all time because it sounded great to the three people who happened to be in a conference room several years ago in a country far, far away from us? Or you know, what is the best possible way among our execution options on the table to execute on the intent of this policy? And doing that in a scalable fashion, I think writing is probably the most scalable way to do it, because you can write down your thinking once and have it read for literally hundreds of years. And the alternative, and it's something that happens at every organization, I think, is that people maintain sort of like an oral lore of the company, but particularly in a quickly scaling company, the oral lore has some limitations. You have to keep the, because I play too much World of Warcraft and because I intentionally want to hang a bow on this topic and say how absurd it is, like, you know, if you had an explicit title of at your day job of lore master, where, you know, these are the folks of a wizened countenance who have been here since before the flood and understand the rationale for all the decisions, like, you would literally need that to be pretty much an explicit part of somebody's job. And to have a lot of lore masters and some redundancy in your lore masters, and maybe even some sort of like sharding strategy of like which information sits in which lore master's head, such that you don't have a, you know, bus factor problem with regards to like lore master availability and, you know, consistency and partition tolerance, et cetera, et cetera. It's a distributed systems problem to maintain your organizational memory if you don't write things down. If you do write things down, computers are great about preserving documents. Search bars exist. Peaches and cream, it'll be amazing. So organize yourself to write much, much more down than you would ordinarily. There are huge, huge benefits to doing so. I perceive Stripe is probably one of the companies in the world that has gotten the most benefit out of the incredible amount of writing we do internally. I think we could probably almost literally increase it by 10x and still not hit diminishing returns. I'm doing my gut check of, do you really believe that? Or does it just like sound like something that has the ring of being plausible and would sound good on a podcast? And no, I believe like my considered second and third thoughts, hat tip to Terry Pratchett, my second and third thoughts are, no, I really believe it. I could write 10 times as many documents as I do and would probably have a far greater than 10x increase in effectiveness. Penciling down note to self, write more this year.
Wow, that's fascinating. I'm glad that you brought that up. Is there anything that Stripe does internally to make sure that people are quality writers or maybe improve in their writing skills? Or is it something that you guys hire for right away? And, you know, if you're not a good writer, then you're kind of not even considered. Is there anything that you do at that in that sort of realm at all?
We do definitely assess for writing ability in many of our hiring loops. That said, I don't believe writing ability is a static thing. I think you can definitely improve via deliberate practice. We do attempt to support our professional growth as writers, but like candidly, this is one of those areas where we don't have a decision that we're, you know, fully happy with. If I had a magic button that could, you know, subjectively double the writing skill of a colleague, I would be doing basically nothing other than mashing that magic button with respect to any member of Stripe I could point it at. Also, if I had that magic button, I should probably found a company to sell that magic button to Stripe and other people. But that one is what it is. I think writing is much like coding, just such a highly leveraged skill in so many organizations and so many industries that we as a society will basically never be as good at it as we want to be.
Wow. Yeah, that's really interesting. I've heard that, and not with the same degree, I think, as what you just said. But yeah, I know that on our side, obviously, writing and communication in written form is super, super important. So that's a good wake-up call for people out there that are listening to go brush up on your skills and make sure that you're getting feedback on all things that you write down, because that's the only way of getting you to get better. So yeah, no, I think it's a really important one. I'm glad that you brought it up. Patrick, you've been so generous with your time that I don't want to take up too much of it, and you're a busy man, so I'll keep this relatively short, but I do have a couple of closing questions here for you, if that's okay. The first closing question here is, hypothetically, you can't go on your computer or use your phone for 1 year. How do you spend most of your time? Maybe I'll manipulate that question a little bit and ask, if you didn't work in tech, where do you think you would work?
Interesting question there. That would be extremely difficult to me, as my wife can definitely attest to. So because these intellectual interests sometimes grab me and don't let me go, I did have a interest in anti-fraud early in my career, which is plausibly something that could have gotten me working in the financial industry as an underwriter or fraud prevention expert, et cetera, et cetera. Although the financial industry and the tech industry they will have an increasing convergence over the next couple of years, I believe. A thing that I really wanted early in my life was to just get paid for living the life of the mind. So I thought, oh, I'll get a PhD and then become a university professor and teach classes and just think a lot and write down interesting thoughts. And then as I got more exposed to academia, it turns out that's not actually what university professors get paid for. Principally, they get paid for filing out grant applications. One of the things that I've liked about my somewhat oddly shaped career in tech is that both as a business owner and now working at Stripe, I really do sort of get paid for living the life of the mind. And so if there are other plausible ways to achieve that outside of the tech industry, I might end up attempting to walk down one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great answer. So my next question here is, what is your biggest pet peeve in business and in tech?
I think people over-optimize in the direction of being able to regurgitate quote-unquote wisdom rather than being able to seek knowledge. And so there are many, many deep structural reasons why this is the case, but what are the best practices and memorize them and then apply them mindlessly? Or what is the narrative that is presented in high status publications, be it media or some other source of news, information, opinion, advice, etc., rather than making like considered decisions as to what things you'll get good at and what getting good at them looks like. I believe that most folks don't do enough experimentation with regards to either their core beliefs about their core comparative advantage, also probably don't do enough experimentation on just like testing the truth value of propositions that are really important to them. And it sort of pains me when folks are, let's say, intellectually uncurious with respect to things that are directly relevant to their interests. That I buy that as someone that has a finite budget of time and attention, you can't experimentally investigate every claim in the world. But I think that most people would do better to subject more claims to more scrutiny than they do in their resting case in life.
Yeah, no, that's a really good one. Do you think that that's changed since you've been working in tech, or is that something that's sort of been constant in your opinion?
I think that this is an issue that I have more with the human condition rather than the tech industry per se. There is sort of a meme in the tech industry of being very scientific with regards to approaches. Sometimes I believe that is a meme that propagates because the meme flatters our self-conceptions more than being an accurate description of how we work. But I think there is some non-zero degree of truth with respect to it. Would support us titrating up with the amount of science that we have. Also, by the way, to throw myself under the bus there, that use of titrate is a very considered use of the word titrate because it sounds scientific, even though I'm using it in a metaphorical sense there. And I do that automatically to like score applause points with engineers. And I know that it automatically gets me sort of like unearned applause from engineers, but yet do it because it is instrumentally effective. So there is no level at which this is not a problem.
Yeah, I love that question. Really, really interesting answer. So I have one more question for you before we let you go, Patrick. And again, thank you so much for taking the time. My last question is, what is the best advice you've ever been given?
Instrumentally, the most important advice I was ever given, and which I repeat at any opportunity, is to charge more. I believe that most people in tech, both those that are selling products and those that are selling their services to companies, have a anchoring of the worth of those products and services far below their true worth. And that this is so widespread, and the delta between the true worth and our sort of implicit emotional comfort levels and the anchorings is so wide, such that I can give people the advice, whatever you're charging, just charge more than that number. And that ends up being value maximizing advice for more than 98% of the people that I tell it to, such that I don't caveat it at all. There are people listening to the podcast today who you are currently wondering, am I ready to get a raise? And the answer is, you have been ready since the day you were first employed in this job. And you should work up the courage to ask to it. You are currently modeling that as being a very difficult involved process. You will find that after you broach the conversation, that it is given to you almost immediately. And you know the fact that I've had this conversation in many forums over 15 years and know that one plus of you is going to make $10,000 as a result of executing on this for literally single digit minutes, like blows my mind. And the incredible leverage of that advice is why I'm sort of like pot committed to repeating it for the rest of my life.
That's an easy win, I think, for a lot of people. And again, you don't get it unless you ask. So I think that's good advice. Well, fantastic. Patrick, again, thank you so much. Was there anything else that you wanted to add before we take off here?
I think I'm pretty good with respect to the conversation we had today. And thanks again for having me. I'm Paddy11 on Twitter and also Paddy11 at stripe.com if anyone has any questions. We are, as I mentioned earlier, hiring extremely aggressively with respect to remote engineers and a variety of other remote positions. Also, on-site positions in, let's see if I can do the list of 15 locations off the top of my head, probably can't. San Francisco, Seattle, New York, Boston, Chicago, Japan, specifically Tokyo, Singapore, Dublin, Mexico City, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're hiring all over the place, and we would very much like to make your acquaintance. We will likely be having another remote coffee in the not-too-distant future. If you follow me, Patio11, on Twitter, or follow Stripe on Twitter, you can get the details of how to participate when that happens. I would expect them to happen at roughly a monthly cadence from here on out.
That's awesome. We'll link to all those things, including all the hiring pages that the Stripe has up. And we're, again, super thankful to you and to Stripe to be able to talk to you today. And maybe at some point in the future, we'll be able to go into this one again, because I think there's a lot more that we can cover. And this is probably, I think, one of our longest podcasts already. And I'm sure we have another 3 or 4 hours of content if we really pull it apart. So thank you so much, Patrick, again. And hopefully we get to talk to you again soon.
Thanks very much. And anyone, if I can ever help you out, I work for the internet, so drop me a line.
All right. Thank you, Patrick. Thanks so much again for listening to the show. Be sure to check out WeWorkRemotely.com for the latest remote jobs. And if you're looking to hire a remote worker, WeWork Remotely is the fastest and easiest way to do so. As always, if you have someone we should talk to, any advice you have, or if you'd like to advertise on the podcast, please reach out to us at podcast@WeWorkRemotely.com. That's podcast@WeWorkRemotely.com. Thanks so much again for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.